from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Washington Post called award-winning filmmaker, Bay Area author, and UC Berkeley professor emeritus Timothy Ferris the best science writer of his generation, and he'll join us in studio for Forum's Hour coming up. His new book connects the political revolution, which brought liberal democracy to nearly half of the world, to the scientific revolution, which illuminated our lifespans and the cosmos. Timothy Ferris joins us for the hour, which will include your calls, your emails, and your online questions and comments. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Timothy Ferris has been described by the Washington Post as the best science writer of his generation and by the Christian Science Monitor as the best popular science writer in the English language today. The author of a dozen books, including Coming of Age in the Milky Way and The Whole Shebang, which the New York Times called two of the most important books of the 20th century. He's also an award-winning filmmaker responsible for three PBS specials, Seeing in the Dark, Life Beyond Earth, and The Creation of the Universe. A frequent contributor to both The New Yorker and The New York Times Review of Books, he's also former editor of Rolling Stone, and he's published in Harper's, Life, Newsweek, National Geographic, and The New York Times. A professor emeritus at UC Berkeley and Bay Area resident, Tim Ferris produced the Voyager's phonograph record and served as a consultant with NASA. His newest book is a sweeping intellectual history of the connections between the scientific revolution and the political revolution, and how they are really conjoined and alike, and how democratic states that guarantee democracy and human rights to their citizens who elect their leaders also help directly the spread of scientific knowledge and the freedom that allows for it to advance. Timothy Ferris joins us in studio for this opening hour, and good to see you again.
Same here, Michael. Thank you.
You're here with me on what is my 17th anniversary officially behind
this
microphone. That's a kind of a startling number and a little scary and sobering, but glad to have you to kind of kick things off here. Because I found this new book fascinating. I mean, let's kind of get to the thesis first. The thesis is science really sparked democracy and democracy nurtures science.
Yeah, the histories that I read as a boy dated the Enlightenment from 1688, the onset of what the British like to call their glorious revolution. But to my mind, a better day, but just 1 year earlier, 1687, when Isaac Newton published his Principia, which demonstrated the extraordinary power of science not to explain things. Anybody can explain things, but to make accurate predictions. And that really put teeth in the Enlightenment. You know, the Enlightenment's often portrayed as a battle between reason and superstition, which in some ways it was. But reason had been around for a long time. What was new was science, because the idea of science is that you use experiment to determine which of your reasonable ideas apply to the real world. Thanks to the Enlightenment, we had the Democratic Revolution, as a result of which 40% of the people in the world now live in liberal democracies, a welcome step. And virtually all the good science that has been done over the centuries has been done in those democratic countries. So it seemed to me that was no coincidence, and I wanted to write a book about it.
Well, it's symbiotic, I guess. And the Democratic Revolution, you say, was sparked by science and not coincidentally sparked by science.
No, it's that's one of the things that had troubled me, was that the origin of the modern world is depicted in history books as a series of coincidences. Suddenly, different philosophers began to write these things, and then we got the modern era. If you go back and you say, what was new? Well, the new ingredient was science, which arose right at that time and flourished really with the publication of Newton's book, which transfixed European thought. It really changed everything, and the world has been changed ever since, and for the better. So the world, people are better off. They're healthier. We live twice as long. Better education. All these things have come about as a result of the liberalizing influence of the symbiotic relationship, as you say, between science and liberal democracy.
What sometimes is confusing, though, and I think you just alluded to this before, is the idea that discoveries take place as opposed to the experiment that proves those discoveries, or not even discoveries, but just assertions, really.
Yes, there have been lots of, you know, the history of philosophy is full of reasonable assertions about things, some of which have proved to be of lasting value. But as Aristotle put it, the only way you had to evaluate arguments back then was either by their internal logic or by how they compared to other arguments and analyses. And I'm sorry to say that the majority of the world's intellectual life still takes place under those Aristotelian limits. There is, however, another method, and that's science. And in science, you evaluate ideas through experiment, and it's a feedback loop. And as you come back through the loop, you can alter or discard ideas that fail the verdict of experiment. And that, you know, it's funny because it's still fairly new in the world, only about four centuries old. So there's still a tendency, I think, for people to underestimate science, to say, well, science is okay in its place, but it can't tell, you know, it can tell you about quantity, but not quality. It can tell you about thoughts, but not emotions. I wouldn't be so sure about that. We're still quite early in this game.
Well, in terms of neuroscience, we're finding out everything more each day that we didn't know before.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes people can react to this and they say, well, I don't want to find out that all of my thinking is merely something that can be analyzed by science. But the mere is a gratuitous phrase. The brain looks much more wonderful now than it did a century ago because we know a lot more about it, and the reason we do is because scientists have been studying it. So we don't know what the limits are of liberalism, real liberalism, which is the original liberalism, which is simply the political philosophy that people should be free, which has nothing to do with either the right or the left. You can be a liberal conservative or a liberal progressive, although many and both sides are not.
You mean freedom of speech and association and
yeah,
and
the Bill of Rights, yeah. The philosophy of John Locke. That is that liberalism that is symbiotic with science. It's not the science is not, as far as I can tell, science has no inherent connection to any other political philosophy. There's nothing inherently right-wing or left-wing about science, but it is inherently liberal.
But, of course, you take examples, and let's talk about one that, that gives one considerable pause, the Tuskegee experiments.
Well, they're horrible things, but my point is it's important to talk about the real world. My point is not that every scientific experiment is morally defensible or that scientists never do anything cruel or stupid or that scientists are any better than anybody else. None of those points is important to my argument. It's simply that if you want to get in the game, if you want to have science in your country, if you're in a country like, say, Iran, a young population, growing educational levels, ambitions for a better future, you need to have a secular democratic form of government. You need to have a Bill of Rights that's heeded by that government. That's the starting condition. And by the way, you need to spend about 2% of your GDP on scientific research and development. Now, you might not choose to do that, but if you don't, you will not get into the science game. And you'll continue to be getting your ideas and buying your technology from other countries forever.
Of course, one could argue that Iran is very much in the science game now with what they're doing in uranium enrichment, and North Korea is in the science game, and these are terrible autocracies and repressive regimes and nothing like liberal democracy, and yet they continue to advance, and the genie gets out of their bottles as well.
Yeah, but that's all. That's not science. It's just nuclear engineering, and it's all imported from abroad. The uranium program was based on stolen espionage documents, as was that of Nazi Germany. So these totalitarian regimes certainly have ambitions, which they try to fulfill by using the power of science. And they try to some degree to set up scientific institutions in their unfree countries. But it hasn't worked. It didn't work in the Soviet Union. It didn't work in Nazi Germany. It's not working today in North Korea. And I'm afraid it won't even work in China so long as the government of China is undemocratic. The Chinese are spending a lot of money on trying to improve their scientific establishment. The Chinese people deserve a world-class scientific establishment. But I don't believe they're going to get it until they have a liberal government.
China's actually doing a lot now on the global warming front, much more than anyone would have anticipated. And curious to get your sense, because you do write about global warming, and suddenly climate change has replaced, with these terrible winter storms, has replaced the use of global warming, as if somehow, and because of the email scandal and everything, there's a reluctance to say global warming now.
Yeah, I think that's a mistake. I think you should just call things what they are, and global warming is global warming, and we don't need to be changing the wording around. It's true that people don't know much about this subject, so it's easy to ignore it. And a lot of folks don't want to think about it for obvious reasons. It's maybe it's scary. It's important to understand the scientific case for global warming is simple and straightforward, and it goes back more than two centuries. There's just been all sorts of research all over the world. This isn't something new, and it's not even that difficult to understand. People who, for whatever reason, want to reject evidence of global warming will often say, well, the models aren't perfect. The models are never perfect in any science. It's not based on those models anyway. Those models are designed to do things like try to tell you just what happens when you flood San Francisco Bay by another meter. You know, you don't need them to tell you about global warming. The science of global warming is quite straightforward. And I know it's frustrating to folks who understand this to see that we seem to be kind of going backwards. You know, we lost 8 years in the Bush administration. We didn't get anything done on global warming. Now, fewer Americans than just 2 years ago even accept that global warming is real or that humans would have anything to do with it. It is frustrating, but it's in the nature of these democratic societies that it always looks like this. It always looks horrible in the short term, and yet somehow in the long term they muddle through better than any other form of government.
Would you say that the Bush administration was perhaps not living up to the ideals of liberal democracy as you define them in the book because of the politicization of science that went on to such a great extent during those 8 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to overstate because the National Science Foundation funding, for instance, went up, I believe it's correct to say, every year during the Bush administration. So a certain amount of it was just rhetoric. But from my standpoint, what's interesting is that when you find regimes that or tend to be anti-scientific, they also tend to be illiberal. So the same Bush administration that certainly took some actions that were against scientific research also were quick to infringe against the Bill of Rights. This was the same administration. This was a president who asserted that he had the right to kidnap any American citizen and hold that person without habeas corpus if that person was suspected of being a terrorist. Now, the president does not have that right, and to think so is to fail to understand the nature of the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, we had Gary Wills on last week, and he said, what a great deal of confusion about the idea of commander-in-chief we've come to. And, of course, it goes back to the Manhattan Project and all its secrecy and the development of the atomic bomb as well as its explosion in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But let me go back with you to the American Revolution, because there's so much really that lays the foundation for what you're writing about here. Thomas Paine, who remains a heroic figure to Glenn Beck and many other would-be
Glenn Beck
stalwart Americans. Well, but science played a much greater role in, probably than even Glenn Beck, who considers himself an expert on Tom Paine, realizes.
Yes, Thomas Paine was an amateur scientist, as, of course, was Thomas Jefferson. And Ben Franklin was the greatest scientist in the Americas in his time. It was all part of the package. Tom Paine, when he was a young man in London, took his winnings from his one voyage on a warship and set himself up in a little flat in London. And one of the first things he did was to buy two globes at a science store. One was a celestial globe and the other one the Earth. And you gentlemen displayed these things to show that they were hip to the modern technology and they also that they understood that this was just one planet in a wider universe. Thomas Paine wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages of really quite beautiful science writing about this insight and how it changes your view of the world. So the reason I have a chapter in The Science of Liberty about the American Revolution is that this country was founded on an ethos that was in turn based on science, and I'm prepared to debate anybody who thinks it was founded on something other than that.
By contrast, the French Revolution, as you write about it, despite the influence of people like Locke and Hume, somehow wound up with Robespierre.
It did, and the reason was reason. I think the French were victims of their own philosophical tradition. because French philosophy, and I really haven't escaped from this either, because French philosophy had such a glittering tradition, and as illustrated by René Descartes, who thought that he could reconstruct all knowledge from a sheer syllogism based on a single assumption that, you know.
Cogito ergo sum. We haven't got past that dualism, have we?
I think, you know, which is not even a good argument logically. But for this reason, the French tended to assume that the purpose of revolution, like the American Revolution, which they had supported and had been so inspiring to their people, that its purpose was, instead of maximizing freedom, was to enact some rationally perfect form of union in which new perfect people would emerge. It's a very pernicious idea. It's killed millions of people, and it started killing people in the French Revolution. It was particularly embodied in the work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and I was cautioned by a reviewer in the New York Times yesterday that I should be more sympathetic to the likes of Rousseau, Karl Marx, and Martin Heidegger. I don't think so, and it pains to explain why none of us should be sympathetic to those three villains.
Well, a lot of people see Rousseau as the antithesis of John Calvin, you know, because he was talking noble savage and Calvin was talking about predestination. So there's a celebration of a lot of what Rousseau represents on that level. But
you're quite right. But when you're talking about politics, you know, how to govern states today and how to do what liberal democracy has done so far, which is to increase the material well-being of people around the world by a factor of 10. We've gone from a per capita GDP of $700 worldwide to over $7,000 today in under 200 years. Nothing like that, remotely like that, has ever happened in all human history. When you look at those kinds of accomplishments, it's important to look at the philosophers involved in the philosophical context as it applies really to modern life and how what we can use, rather than always be back in a historical framework. And there's been a lot of movement by historians for good reasons to get more back into the past and that frame of reference. But Rousseau, however useful he may have been in the short term, and that must have been pretty darn short because he became the inspiration of the French Revolution when Robespierre was cutting people's heads off every hour. He was talking about how, you know, what a great man Rousseau had been and how inspiring he was. Rousseau is also the patron saint of Adolf Hitler, for instance. I think, you know, there comes a point where you have to say, look, this guy was a madman with a fact-free philosophy that continues to be taught in schools to this day and which leads people to a lot of mistaken conclusions, among them that of the noble savage, the idea that we humans used to be peaceful and that somehow private property came along and made us warlike. We now know enough from studying prehistoric cultures such as the ones that have survived in the modern times and such to have some idea of just how peaceful they are. And if say, New York City today were as peaceful as an average Stone Age society, the murder rate in New York City would be about 100 persons per day. The actual rate's under 3 per day. So the world that Rousseau dreamed up and which has so influenced so many dictators and romantics never existed.
If you want to see how wacky Rousseau really was, read the Confessions, because you get a whole different picture of him than the political philosopher or the man who has been elevated to almost sanctioned as this noble savage idea. But let's talk about some of the other figures who are important in this. I mean, you talk about science, but you also talk about the dismal science. You mentioned Adam Smith, for example, and those who made, through democracy, made us more aware of wealth and just the way things function in terms of economics.
Yeah, economics is a science, and it's often given short shrift, and I think unfairly so. What people say, as you say, is that, well, it's the dismal science, which had to do with the theory of Tom Malthus and not with economics really at all. Economics, like all sciences, is imperfect, but it has provided headlights such that nations are much better governed in economic terms today than they were in the past. Now, I know we're in the middle of a recession and global recession, a lot of problems have turned up, and it's an easy time to be cynical about economics. But the founder of economics, Adam Smith, erected as one of his most fundamental points, he kept going back to it again and again, that markets have to be properly regulated. They weren't. During the Bush administration, we had a team that met, we Americans, that met every week, the Justice Department, for the sole purpose of redlining out every market regulation that they had the power to get rid of, which was thousands of such regulations. I guarantee you the people doing that in many cases did not even understand what it was that they were invalidating or why it was there in the first place. You do that long enough, you will get disaster, and that's what happened just before Mr. Bush left office.
You're talking about 200 years before, and there's some wonderful epigraphs in your book. I think it's the first chapter where you have a quote of Jefferson's talking about liberty as the parent of science and virtue, and then going 200 years forward to Freeman Dyson, who talked about essentially science being subversive in historical terms.
Yes, science is inherently anti-authoritarian because it freshly tests ideas, including the old revered ideas. So it doesn't matter how great an authority taught something. If a valid scientific experiment shows it to be false, that's the end of the story. You're going to go on to new ideas.
But there's two centuries of the same idea in many ways. I mean,
yeah.
Science giving birth really to liberty and liberty being sort of predicated upon science.
That's right, and it's still true, and it's still the same dynamic. When Thomas Jefferson was vaccinating his family and arguing in favor of smallpox vaccination to ease the tremendous suffering that smallpox was imposing on people at that time, he was opposed by church authorities. He said it was against the rule of God to vaccinate anybody. And we see that going on to today, that there really are kind of a spectrum of thought. At one extreme, one end of that spectrum, you have the scientific view that let's find out about things, let's conduct experiments, let's keep learning, we don't know that much. And the other end of the spectrum is we're not meant to or we can't learn all that much. Everything we're supposed to know is in this revered book I have here in my hand, regardless of which book it is. And those two mentalities have been in conflict ever since science got going.
Talking with Timothy Ferris, and again, his new book is The Science of Liberty, which we're discussing, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. Reason plays in here. How?
Reason? Well, scientific theories have to be logical, although sometimes even that gets bent a little bit because some of the discoveries have been so surprising. Quantum mechanics has rules that wouldn't have made sense under ordinary prior classical logic. But they also have to be scientific ideas, also have to be empirical. They have to be based on controlled experiment, and that's been the tremendous breakthrough. So you have a set of reasonable ideas, and then you have a subset of reasonable ideas that have also been verified by experiment. And that second set is much more useful than just the things that are reasonable. People have reasoned themselves into some really pretty silly and in some cases tragic positions.
I'm going to invite those of you listening to join this conversation. In fact, you're welcome to do so, and we welcome your calls. You can call us now, in fact, toll-free at 866-733-6786 and join this discussion. It's a toll-free number, and it's available to those of you listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or you can go online and put your comments or questions on our website, kqed.org, and find the segment that we're talking about, which is with Tim Ferriss. It's his new book, Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Tim Ferriss, and his new book is called The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. He's a Bay Area resident and UC Berkeley professor emeritus, nominee for both the Pulitzer and National Book Award, among other things. Let's go to your calls, and we'll begin, Chris, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I very much look forward to the book. I must say there are a few things I have taken issue with in the conversation, one calling Karl Marx a villain. But anyway, my question to you, and my kind of stating my question here, if science and politics are so linked, and it seems to Tim Ferriss is saying that certainly wants science to proliferate. And at some point, wouldn't it be best, or what would you think about having a global government as creating a more peaceful world and a kind of world that's going to put science in a nice high place?
Well, if the world is going one day to have a single government, then it'll be up to the individual peoples of the world to make that decision. I'm a big fan of grassroots control. One of the precepts of liberalism is that you minimize any organization that has the power to abridge your liberties, and the most powerful of those organizations is government. So before we jump to the notion that, you know, we'd love to have a all-powerful government as long as it did the right thing, we should keep in mind that if you surrender your freedoms to any government, then your ability to decide whether it's going to keep doing the right thing is lost. So I suspect we're a long way away from having a world government. I think the right way to support science is because people support science. NASA has a budget of about $15 billion a year because that's what the American public's prepared to spend on NASA. And we can argue that, well, gee, they ought to spend more, they ought to spend less, but that's their decision, and it's arrived at over decades. And I've come to have a lot of reliance in the good sense of great masses of ordinary people.
When I was a young man studying international relations, I thought world government was a really good idea. If you could do something about sovereignty, you would indeed maybe eliminate nationalism if you had the liberal democracy type of world government. But now we live in such a different global world that it almost seems to be literal. It was then too, but even more of an impossible dream because you have all these factional and fractious terrorist groups which don't pay any attention to sovereignty anyway, let alone would they pay attention to a world government. Why is Karl Marx a villain to you? I guess that caller is raising that question.
Well, I don't mean to call him personally a villain. I don't, unlike Rousseau.
He's been used villainously, certainly, by Pol Pot and people like that. But is he a villain?
That's true. I mean, Marx himself was certainly not a Pol Pot or a Rousseau or a Heidegger. Those people really were villains. The philosophy is villainous for the reason that all bad political philosophy is villainous, and that is because it was written out of ignorance of the way people really are and how they really interact. Any Chicago ward healer to this day has a better knowledge of how politics works than Karl Marx ever had on any day of his life.
There's also a man who never knew what unions would be, or never foresaw.
There are a lot of things he couldn't foresee, and I'm not objecting to Karl Marx's career or his right to do what he did. That was all fine. But the context was that a critic in the New York Times said, I should have written more sympathetically about these three figures. Now, Karl Marx's philosophy, put into practice, killed 30 million human beings in my lifetime through state-sponsored famine alone. Let's just pause for a second and think about that. 30 million people dead because of communist governments. That's only a fraction of the total fatality of those governments, but just of famine.
The Marxists would tell you that was a distortion of Marx's belief and Marx's ideology.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry, but they had a chance to experiment with a third of the world. And those leaders did not say, oh, we're doing this wrong or we're going to change it. They said, we're Marxists. This is a communist government. I'll take their word for it. We're not going to run that experiment again. And it was a villainous experiment.
And Martin Heidegger was a Nazi. I mean, pure and simple.
Flat out Nazi, who spent most of his post-war career lying about the fact that he had been a Nazi.
Did he lie as much as Thomas de Maine? I don't know. Dillard, good morning. You're on the air. Dillard from San Jose.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Dillard from San Jose.
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Yeah. My question is about the connection of science and how it is connected to evolution in religion. I believe in science, and I believe that there has been evolution in religion, which is connected to prosperity of society. Let me just explain it. Like, Hinduism has been a very old religion, but hardly any change there. And then Christianity came along, and then there were some problems, and then Islam came along, like, as an evolution in religion. And that did not change, but then Christianity evolved in around 1500s. And that evolution in Christianity has been the main reason for prosperity, in the Western countries. So this, my belief in theory of evolution, says that around 1500s, Christianity and science were connected, and that's why Christianity evolved. If that is true, Then my question is, what role did it play regarding Islam around, you know, 400, 500 AD when Islam came up and was an evolution for that time? Later it didn't change, but for that time it was an evolution.
Well, term evolution, maybe it's not the best term to use in biology, you know, because biological evolution doesn't mean that things improve and get better. It's just a dynamic. And the way biological evolution looks is so fascinating that I think we humans are still trying to begin to picture what the world looks like once you understand it. I mean, it's as if every room is full of ghosts, and they're the ghosts of all the life forms that aren't there but might have been. You know, when you ask yourself, why am I here? It's kind of the wrong question. You're here because otherwise you wouldn't be asking this question. All the millions who aren't here don't get to ask the question. And so much philosophy started from that erroneous question when now, thanks to evolution, one can say, how might the world have been different? What are the zillions of ways that the world might have been different? And how did it happen that things turn out to be the way they are at this moment?
You pretty much accept sort of the Stephen Jay Gould approach to evolution, that there's a lot of caprice and accidental things that occurred that allowed evolution to take place the way it has?
Well, I think everyone does, really. It's there's no question that there – not just life, but all the history of the universe is full of what are called frozen accidents, accidents that represent a real fork in the road and the world goes down one fork instead of another. And evolution's just full of that. I'm not so sure about Steve's attempt to erect a permanent wall between religion and science. As a matter of good fences, making good neighbors, that's fine. But, the older I get, the more I realize the fallacy of philosophies that try to bifurcate the world. One of the great discoveries of science has been that the world is not bifurcated. They're not two universes. They're not two worlds. They're not two kinds of people or two kinds of cats. It's all one thing. So I'm a little skeptical of trying to solve philosophical clashes by saying, well, you know, it's just two different kinds of things, and they'll never meet. They've already been meeting.
How do you explain in a liberal democracy which fosters science and certainly continues to progress because of science, the great preponderance of people within this liberal democracy, the United States, that still, number one, don't believe in evolution. Number two, you mentioned ghosts. Believe in ghosts. Or, is it a failure of our educational system? Or I'm sort of puzzled to some extent by why, given especially the equation you're working here, we're progressing.
Sure. I don't view the purpose of education as being to change people's orientation in school into something that's more suitable, say, to my own sensibility. I do think that we need to teach students science, and we're not doing a terribly good job of that. It's not clear why, by the way. The United States spends more per student on public education than any other major country in the world. We're third in the world after, I think, Switzerland and Belgium. But somehow we're not getting our money's worth in terms of education. As to why, that's always been the nature of the American culture. We've always had a strong religious component. I'm sorry that some religious folks in America seem to think that their religion excludes their paying attention to the plain facts of science. But it's not a new situation. It's not going to go away tomorrow.
More of your calls. Neil, join us. Good morning.
Hello. Yeah. You know, in answer to that last point you made, why is it so hard to educate people in science? I would suggest one possibility is that the more obscurantist religions are having a much higher birth rate and the more, shall we say, enlightened religious traditions are having a low birth rate. Anyway, that's just a possibility. Getting back to your own thesis, I think you're absolutely correct in making a distinction between science on one hand and engineering and technology on another. I think totalitarian societies can produce all kinds of engineering as to, from the pyramids on, and I would even question you a little bit on pure science. How about Imperial Germany and Japan, especially Germany? Those weren't exactly democratic societies, yet they did have some pretty good pure science. And my final point is, in this year, of all years, the 400th anniversary of Galileo, how can you not include Galileo as one of the principal beginnings of modern science? His experiments, he definitely had, and it was followed by people like Kepler and Tycho Brahe. Anyway, those are my points.
Well, I thank you for mentioning Galileo, because that's a good point. Galileo's observations, 1609, are often considered the beginning of the scientific revolution.
I must confess I had the same thought. You know.
Yeah, it's hard to know when to date the beginning of science from. And for my argument, it's not necessary to take on the question of why science happened to originate where and when it did. It seems to me that if you have a society in which people are making tools and have some incentive to make where you can make a little money with a better tool, then you're much more likely to get science sooner or later than if you have a society of scholars who are constantly debating ideas. So I think you're quite right about mentioning Galileo.
Thank the caller, and go to more of your calls in just a moment. We'll go to some of your emails, though. Here's Scott, who writes, "The guest starts to make sense, and then he nullifies it all with his blame Bush rhetoric. Bush went wrong trying to get liberals to like him. Obama's solution, blame Bush, then repeat Bush's and their predecessors' economic mistakes tenfold."
Well, if his point is that I blame the Bush administration for the market deregulations that led to the crash at the end of the Bush administration, yeah, I do. It's not rhetoric. I'm not being rhetorical. I'm just saying that presidents get blamed for what happens on their watch. It happened on his watch, and there's some very good reasons why.
By the way, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or you can join comments or questions online by just visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Michael from San Francisco wants to know, what does your guest think of the concept of scientism?
Scientism is a word invented by French fascists to scare people away from taking scientific evidence seriously, from taking it to heart. And it's been used since by postmodernists, whose roots are in French fascism, to scare people away from science.
That's right. You do mention the postmodernists, which, I mean, in the same kind of breath that you mention fascists and Islamic fundamentalists.
Well, because it's the same campaign. I mean, the postmodernism is a totalitarian attack on liberalism and, interestingly, also on science. The key point in the postmodernist campaign, which isn't quite as dead as people seem to think, is that all knowledge is just culturally conditioned and relative, and that therefore scientific knowledge is just a bunch of stories made up to tell us, tell kids about where the universe came from. A good example of the level of scholarship is that Bruno Latour, a French sociologist and a leading postmodernist, published a paper saying that a recent scientific finding that one of the ancient Egyptian kings, Ramses, whichever it was, appeared to have died of pneumonia, tuberculosis, could not be the case because the tuberculosis bacillus was not discovered until the 19th century. Now, Mr. Latour may be having some fun at everyone's expense, but among those whose expense it is are the millions of college students who've been taught this nonsense for decades now.
We also have the figure, it's kind of almost a mythic figure, but nevertheless of one that stays in the archetypical consciousness of so many of the mad scientists and science gone amok.
Yeah, another anti-science myth is the Faust myth, the idea that scientific research is all very well, but it must not be allowed to go too far. And we have opposition from both the right and the left, to people who on both the right and the left who want to restrict scientific research to prevent what they imagine might otherwise happen. I find it's useful to, in these situations, just ask your people who think this to go back and tell me what scientific knowledge in the past they would rather we didn't have. They would have proposed that we had headed off. Usually what they answer is, well, nuclear weapons. But if you don't understand how to make nuclear weapons, you don't know how the sun shines. So you're opting for fairly substantial career of ignorance. And also, you know, if you don't figure it out, somebody else is going to.
Another email comes to us from Doug, who writes, "In light of your praise of democracy doing so much to lift humankind out of poverty and despair, could you please tell me why capitalism trumps democracy every time?"
Capitalism and democracy are not competitive systems, as Michael Moore seems to think. Capitalism is our term for liberal economics. Capitalism is a system. It's not necessarily the only system, but it's the only one I know of that's functioning.
Moore up there with Marx and Volt and Rousseau, by the way?
No. I don't have any animus against Michael. But he said on television recently that capitalism and democracy are opposites. That's simply an ignorant statement. That there's no way you can understand politics and believe that to be true. The great boon to people's well-being around the world has been free market economics, and for those on the left who take a position against this to say that it can't be true because it offends their ideology, and also to claim that they care about the poor is really contradictory. If you care about the poor, you have got to take seriously that the most successful anti-poverty program in the history of the world, more successful than every other prior effort combined, has occurred in just the last few decades. Almost half of the most desperately poor people in the world have been lifted out of poverty. Every one of the five quintiles, as they're called, the 20% groups of people around the world, every one of those groups has increased substantially in income over just the last 30 years. It seems to me if you care about the poor, you clearly want to know what did that, and not be standing on the sidelines saying, oh, well, I don't like it because it's capitalism.
Another listener, Robert, writes, Mr. Ferris's points are very well taken. I like very much his notion of scientific inquiry as a feedback loop. This is a good description. Scientific inquiry continues honing its assertions without completion. What makes the models of science beautiful is that its theories, which are models of verisimilitude of the natural world, are never perfect. We should note that a very important and not merely semantic feature of science is that the word proof has no part in scientific inquiry. Proof is for the tautological theorems of mathematics and has no place in scientific inquiry. Scientific proof is oxymoronic. Imperfect but very good observations and imperfect but very good reason are the objects of science.
Yeah, that's a good letter. The notion of perfection and of criticizing things because they're not perfect has been one that's done a lot of harm in our history.
On we go. Michael, join us. Good morning.
Hi. I would just like to add to the evidence that science can, under authoritative circumstances, still produce a lot of good results. I mean, Lavoisier, for instance, founder of modern chemistry, basically Mendeleev, Leibniz, all these people, and Galileo and Bacon, for instance, all these people operated under governments that were really not what you would call liberal democracies, and the guest has not responded to that, and I'd like to
let me respond to it now, because I know someone earlier mentioned the example of Imperial Japan, which actually did rather little science. Imperial Germany, which he characterized as not being democratic, actually, Germany in the latter part of the 1800s was the most liberal state in Europe. There were a number of both liberal and progressive reforms that went on. And during that same time, well, that was the period when Germany really got to be a scientific power. So it's true you can go back to the era of Bacon, when there wasn't a single liberal democracy in the world, and show that there were a few scholars doing some science. Isaac Newton, for that matter, was living in a monarchy. But if you read the book, these are obviously points that I need to address and which are addressed in the book.
We thank the caller, and on we go. We go this time to Santa Rosa. Richard, join us, please.
Good morning, Professor Ferris. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for your comment. Let's see. I'm wondering, back to the discussion of the importance of capitalism rising up at the same time as liberal democracy. I'm pretty sure that this area has been covered pretty thoroughly by the sociologist C. Wright Mills to show that the two can't be pulled apart. And what I'm wondering is your comments on the rise of science as a product of capitalism, especially in relation to that.
Let me just interrupt for a moment to correct, because I wouldn't want you to get the wrong impression. I don't say that science is a result of capitalism or anything of that sort. What I'm saying is that from a scientific standpoint, the way, the empirical way of looking at things, if you're concerned about the poor, you need to pay attention to what works, what actually helps the poor, rather than what's just ideologically acceptable. And that's how capitalism came into this discussion. But excuse me, go ahead.
Well, I was also noting that modern economists seem to feel that their field is scientific, and a lot of principles are fostered as forms of natural law.
Yeah, so economics is a science, yeah.
So we have phenomena like more recently Alan Greenspan admitting to the congressional committee last year, I believe, that he miscalculated his and Randian point of view that maybe the markets don't regulate themselves or on self-interest. Therefore, economics not being quite as scientific, purely scientific as he thought.
Well, let me just Ayn Rand was not an economist. she never published an economics paper. Nowhere in economics that I'm aware of, even in some of the most conservative, you know, or Republican kind of economists, is this claim seriously made that a market will completely regulate itself. The markets produce certain – well, markets are great at setting prices, but the theory that unlike any other human activity, you could just leave the room and have no policing and no regulations and somehow that would all be great. That seems to have been limited to a bunch of ideologues in the Bush White House. It's not a valid position for a professor of economics to take.
Thank Richard for the call and move to more of your emails. David writes, I'm no fan of Marx, but I do admire logic. Your guest blames Marx for the deaths of 30 million people because the theory of his was corrupted and abused. By the same token, how many deaths must Jesus account for?
Well, I'm not here to argue on behalf of the philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth either, but I think it's just astonishing that people become so attached to an ideology that they could see the horrors that happened as a result of communism in action and still say, oh, well, you know, there's something to it. Why? What possibly are you defending by that? A personal affection for old Karl Marx sitting there in the library dreaming up these theories? You know, he's not worth it.
A little theory that I think there's a lot of people who are drawn to Marxism because of its collectivism and because of what they see. It's egalitarianism. It's an idealistic kind of magnet in that way.
Yeah, idealism has not been kind to humans over history.
Another listener says, far more state-sponsored famines were caused by the bayonets of liberal democracies imposing capitalism worldwide than Stalin, as vile as he was, could have ever dreamed.
That's factually false.
Yes, I agree. Serena writes, there was an article in yesterday's New York Times about efforts by Christian activists to incorporate more of a Christian approach to science and education. Actually, I saw that. I found it fascinating. Specifically, this is in Texas. By the Board of Education in Texas. Their textbook standards also happen to influence many other state standards. What's your viewpoint on how to teach science and what it means for liberal democracies?
Well, you certainly don't want to teach it as part of religion. And, you know, one of the reasons we've had such a success with our liberal democracy here in this country is because we have kept religion out of it. The American Baptists, for instance, for over 200 years, were proud of their role in having stayed out of politics. That policy was changed by that organization just a few years ago, and Jimmy Carter withdrew from the organization as a result. And I think religious zealots need to learn a little history. You know, it may be thrilling in the short run to start having some effect on politics and, you know, get to know people in Congress and stuff and throw your weight around. But in the long run, it's not in your interests. And because so few people involved in this effort have read much history, they don't seem to quite appreciate that. So I'm afraid I've wandered a bit off subject, but it is in the interest, speaking as a liberal, as a defender of religious rights, it is in the interest of all my many American friends who are religious believers to keep religion out of schools and to keep it out of politics.
Merrick says, David Kennedy at Stanford and many other professors of American history say our government was designed to protect the interests of powerful, wealthy plutocrats, and that's what we're seeing in operation now. They say we've never been in democracy and never will be without another revolution.
Well, that's unfortunately a position that's been taken on by many on the left, and it's even taught often to students. And in my book, I'm at pains to try to look at objective facts. You know, my book is not written by starting with an ideology and then trying to fill it out. It's an examination of fact. And the same folks who make claims like that, which are really non-factual claims, are also quick to call science itself and to call liberalism ideologies, and they're not. Liberalism and science are methods, and they are to be judged by their experimental results. So if your claim is, for instance, that the United States is just some put-up job by a bunch of plutocrats to enrich themselves, then we would find, for instance, that the American working class had gotten worse and worse off over the years, as Marx predicted would happen. That's a kind of a scientific experiment. You got a couple of sets of predictions. The prediction of Marx and the prediction of those who espouse this current version of Marxism are not borne out by the facts. American working class, the wealthiest working class in the history of the world. The average American household is worth $100,000 in assets minus liabilities. Nobody 2 centuries ago would have conceived of the notion that a nation of this size could ever reach anything like that level of material wealth.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Always good to have you here. Timothy Ferris's new book is called The Science of Liberty, Democracy, Reason, and the Laws of Nature. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
And another hour of Forum coming your way. We're going to talk to a local author who's written a mystery, former co-editor of the outdoor section of the Chronicle, who has done a book, in fact, with a lot of local color and a lot to say about the world of journalism and corruption. Hope you will join us for that. Thank you for joining us for this morning's forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg, and remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. And I thank you for being with us. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.